Les colloques du Collège de France.
Okay, so it's a great pleasure to introduce Joël's keynote. Joël, we've known each other for at least 25 years or even more, and we interacted repeatedly at the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research and the Institution Organization and Growth Meeting, and it was always for me, which organized my research agenda. It was always the prospect of interacting with you on a regular basis. Your work has inspired generations of researchers all over the world, particularly those seeking to pierce the mystery of industrialization and the growth takeoff, and to better understand the history and determinants of technological revolutions. Why did GDP growth, as we currently know it, started in 1820 and not before? Why did the growth takeoff occur in Europe and not in China, despite the fact that major inventions, gunpowder, paper making, printing, had been made in China first? Numerous scholars broke their heads on these questions, and to my judgment, which is shared by many of us in the profession and by everybody in this room, you came up with the most convincing answers. The encyclopedia, which enabled a fruitful dialogue between theoretical knowledge, you call it propositional knowledge, and practical knowledge. The decreasing cost of printing, the emergence of postal services, the free circulation of ideas between inventors and across countries all boosted the diffusion of knowledge and information. And the competition among European nations enabled innovation and creative destruction to take place despite the resistance and opposition of strong vested interests in each individual country in Europe. All those ideas were ideas you pushed and that inspired us very much. You received, Joël, numerous marks of recognition for your seminal contribution to economics and economic history. You have been president of the Economic History Association. You've been editor-in-chief of the Princeton Economic History of the Western World series, editor of the Oxford Encyclopedia of Economic History. You received the Heineken Prize for History in 2006 and the Balzan International Foundation Prize for Economic History in 2015. You are a member of the American Academy of Art and Science, as well as a corresponding member of the Royal Netherlands Academy of Art and Science and many other place academies. You have written numerous research articles published in leading journals, and you have produced best-selling world-known books such as The Lever of Riches, The Gift of Athena, and more recently, A Culture of Growth, The Origins of the Modern Economy. Thinking big is a principle which has inspired your whole academic career, a principle that you have nurtured with your talent, your intelligence, your encyclopedic knowledge. It is my pleasure, my great honor, Joël, to have you deliver this keynote lecture. And thank you for accepting our invitation. Thank you so much.
So, before I start, you know, I got to know three in 1982 when I spent a year at Harvard, pretending unsuccessfully to sound like David Landis. Tzvi and I hit it off basically from day one. You know, he was department chair at the time and invited me. I think every weekend that I stayed in Cambridge, he invited me over to lunch, and he would ask me a large number of questions about economic history, about half of which I knew the answer to. So I tried to manipulate the conversation to talk about the questions I knew the answers to. But, you know, with three, that didn't work. You know, when he figured you didn't know something, he would press on. And eventually I would dash off to, you know, the library and look up the things that three asked me about. And then on Monday I walk in there. Three, you know, you asked me this question. I now know the answer. But, you know, he wasn't fooled. A brilliant man, wonderful fellow. And we stayed in touch for until his passing in 2 decades later. All right, so let me get straight to the point. This is based on joint work, but I'm responsible for all errors. So, very briefly talk about the Industrial Revolution. I don't think people here in this room really need it. It really is, I think, one of the two truly significant transformations in human history, the other one being, of course, the Neolithic Revolution. It created, you know, the kind of sustained growth that had lifted you know, boats all over the world. It's created a great divergence between Europe and China. And most relevant for here today, it's created British economic and technological leadership for, I would say, about a century. And these dates are probably as good as anybody can come up with. Okay. And for a conference on innovation, I think the Industrial Revolution should stand out because it's for the first time in human history that innovation becomes gradually and slowly but certainly the dominant engine of economic growth instead of the kind of Smithian gains from trade or Northian gains from, you know, better allocations and better institutions and things like that. And this matters a great deal because other forms of economic growth are subject to what I call the curse of concavity, right? Basically, it's a fancy way of saying that they're running to diminishing returns because, you know, at some point they both have some kind of upper bound, and we don't know that there's an upper bound in the accumulation of knowledge. So there's two questions that economic historians have asked. I'm going to answer only one of them, and that is, why Britain? And that question is maybe not quite as global as the other one, but it's in some ways easier to answer. And it isn't obvious why Britain, because in 1750, Britain really isn't a particularly good candidate for its leadership, or so it seems. It is neither the largest country, nor the richest, nor the most powerful, not even the best educated or most scientifically advanced nation in Europe. It's okay in almost all of those dimensions, but in every one of those, there's a country that exceeded it. So how should we think of Britain's role in the Industrial Revolution? So I'm going to expose you to something I wrote 40 years ago, and that is sort of a justly neglected analogy of the Industrial Revolution with the rise of Christianity. And this is a direct quote from something that I wrote in my years of Sturm und Drang. And that is, you know, examining British economic history is a little bit like the history of Jewish dissenters between 50 BC and 50 AD. So at first it's provincial, it's localized, even bizarre, but eventually it changed the life of every man, woman, and child in the West beyond recognition. So the geographical stage at which this happened was long quickly taken over by others, but in many ways, Britain will remain the holy land of industrialism. You know, I mean, you read things you wrote 30 years ago, and this will happen to all of you sooner or later. You know, sometimes you feel, gee, you know, I still think that's right. And this is one of those cases. So what was the Industrial Revolution? It's above all, and it's many things, but it's above all a technological event. Okay, there are some major inventions that we all know, and a large number of what I would call tweaks or micro-inventions. A more useful term, I think, here would be useful knowledge. This is not a term that, you know, maybe speaks to people today, but it's actually what they used at that time. And it's basically science and technology, as we would think it, plus some other things that and that's sort of the core of what I've called the Industrial Enlightenment, which I'll talk about some other time. But why Britain? And so I'm going to go very briefly through some of the things that are out there in the literature and then propose an additional explanation. I do not mean to suggest for a minute that I'm rejecting all the other explanations, au contraire, but this is something that hasn't gotten enough attention and I think actually may be more powerful than some of the others, okay? So here are some traditional views. I'll go through it very quickly because that's not the main point. There's obviously geography. Most of the geography argument has two components. One is what I call carbonocentrism, right? So it's coal. Britain had coal. Coal was great. Coal was central. That's what drove the whole thing. You know, people like Tony Wrigley have argued that at great lengths, but so have other people like Ken Pomeranz. Of course, there's also the fact that Britain is an island, which is sort of hard to invade, you know, hasn't really been successfully invaded since 1066. So, you know, it could stay out of the Napoleonic War. In other words, there's no fighting on its territory. There's the institutional school, obviously inspired by Douglas North, but many people have picked it up later on. So one element of that is sort of 1688 and all that. So sort of the Glorious Revolution, you know, particularly Jim Robinson and Steve Pinker, people like that, have been writing about that. Then there is sort of the complementary argument, which is good governments and strong property rights. So people, you know, people like my co-author and former student Avner Greif have written about that. And there's a new book coming out by Greif and Guido Tabellini and myself that takes that along further. It's very popular among political scientists, maybe less so among quantitative economists who've had a hard time testing for it. Then there are some specific British institutions, not quite as, you know, as high level as Doug's, but things. So England has certain things that nobody else does. The one thing is that it has a poor law, which is, you know, nationwide. No other country has anything like that, in which basically it means that nobody is allowed to starve in Britain, and very few people actually do. It has relatively weak guilds. It has a patent system. It's got a bunch of things, relatively reasonable taxation. You know, Britain has a very successful excise tax and no internal tariff barriers, which is, of course, a major advantage. No other country in Europe has that either. France, Germany, Italy, all these countries are either fragmented, or even if they are one country like Spain or France, there still are internal tariff barriers, not in England. Then there is imperialism. You know, if you hang out in a history department as I do, you get to hear this all the time. You know, Britain got rich because it stole the resources of other countries and because it enslaved other people. This is very popular in sort of the circles of what's known as history of capitalism. Economists have sort of mixed feelings about it, to put it sort of relatively mildly. Then there is Robert Allen's view about which is essentially induced innovation. That's very much a thesis that spoke to economists. The argument is Britain has high wages, and so that induces labor-saving technological change. You know, when it first came out, people sort of nodded and say, yeah, that all makes sense. As we look closer at it, doubts have crept in, and anybody interested in that literature can look it up. Then there is sort of the contingency school, which is, I think, is kind of, you know, interesting. It was proposed originally by Nick Crafts. Basically says, look, I mean, if it hadn't been for the French Revolution and Napoleon and these wars and all the upheaval, maybe France would have overtaken Britain. So Britain was just lucky that France sort of self-destructed between 1789 and 1815, or had, you know, maybe Nelson lost at Trafalgar, things would have been very differently. I'm not totally sure what to make of that, but so here are some other suggestions. So there is stuff that I've written about the Industrial Enlightenment, sort of arguing about sort of cultural factors, you know. So Britain has an enlightenment, but it's very different than France's. It's much less aimed against the political establishment and much more sort of pragmatic and applied and, you know, focused on concrete problem solving. This is an argument that was made by Roy Porter years ago, but I think it contains some truth. Deirdre McCloskey's work on the Industrial Revolution, I mean, I have tried to summarize 2,000 pages in three volumes in her great trilogy in this very short sentence. Now, I'm not sure she... But basically, free innovation led by the bourgeoisie became at long last respectable. Okay, but I think that's probably a fair summary of Deirdre's magnum opus, but, you know, if that doesn't absolve you from actually having reading those 2,000 pages. And then there's finally the psychological view. This is actually proposed by a cognitive scientist here in Paris, Nicolas Baumard. And basically what he argued is that because Britain already had a higher income per capita on the eve of the Industrial Revolution, it actually affected the way people ended up later in life. So this is based on some kind of psychological life history theory, that people who do not grow up in abject poverty tend to be more inclined toward entrepreneurial behavior, are more cooperative, more trusting, and publicly minded. And so I thought that's kind of an interesting thing. I'll come back to it. So let me briefly, as an introduction, to propose something of a new approach to these kind of dynamic processes in history. And so here is one way of thinking about it. You know, we can think about much of economic history before the Industrial Revolution, certainly before 1600, as a negative feedback loop. Okay, so the two negative feedback loops that count, and I could think of more, but these are the one is this Malthusian dynamics, so deeply beloved by Odette Galore and his school, which basically says, look, any positive productivity shock leads to rising incomes, that causes rising birth rate and possibly declining death rates. And so population growth, there's diminishing returns to fixed factor and declining income. So incomes never grow because as soon as they start to grow, it sets into operation forces that will reduce it. An alternative view, which complements this, is what I call political dynamics or the rapacity effect. So you can think about many places in Europe where there's an increase in income, due to some kind of positive productivity shock. And that does two things. It increases local rent seeking, and it invites sort of neighboring states, which are poorer but predatory, to invade. Now, this can cause to a combination of higher taxes to defend themselves or war-related damage, and that causes deadweight losses and worse incentives. Incomes start to decline. So, you know, what happened, for instance, you know, a good example is the sort of history of Belgium. So Belgium, you know, in the late Middle Ages, Ghent and Bruges and these cities were extremely rich. And then things happen, and eventually, you know, by 1700, you know, that richness is no longer there. You know, and the same is true to a large extent for northern Italy, southern Germany, and so on, okay? So these forces kept the vast majority of the world's economy at a low level of income, or so at least it has been argued by a number of sort of Malthusian inclined scholars. Now, the point, however, is that there are also positive feedback loops that create these sort of what's known as this Matthew effect, right? So the rich get richer at the level of the economy. So this is the quote from Matthew that everybody probably seen, you know. And so, in a way, you could think of dynamic history as sort of a horse race between negative and positive feedback effects. And the question is, you know, which one dominates? So what kind of positive feedback loops can we identify? Well, one is this Beaumart psychological life history in which rising incomes lead to, you know, better behavior and so on, and leads to even further rising incomes. The same is true, of course, on a much more sort of lowbrow physiological level when we're looking at malnutrition. And so low income really means that, you know, at some level people will not be well nourished, not just in the quantity but also in the quality of the diets. That leads to both cognitive and physiological stunting, and that leads to lower income and so on and so forth. And finally, a positive feedback loop is that rising income would lead to more demand for high income elasticity goods produced in cities. So that leads to urbanization and the realization of agglomeration effects, as well as investment in human capital, that leads to further rising productivity and more rising income. So these are three sort of positive feedback loops. And, you know, the question really is which one dominates. And so I'd add one more positive feedback loop, which is going to be central to my story, and that is that with higher income, there are fewer people at a subsistence level of income working in agriculture, producing food for the rest of them, and that leaves room for people doing other things, such as intellectuals, engineers, and so on and so forth. So there are more people available who can spend time on thinking about and tinkering with this useful knowledge, and more technological progress, and so even more higher productivity. And so the argument that I propose to you is this. By 1700 or so, Britain is already a relatively rich country that has succeeded to increase its income per capita way above subsistence. And so what happens is that over the next century, the positive feedback loops overcome the negative feedback loops and created this sort of Matthew effect. Now, understand, that's a description. It's not an explanation. I'll come up with the explanation, but that's basically what I want you to understand. So by the time of Oliver Cromwell, in the middle of the 17th century, we know that Malthusian mechanisms in Britain had already weakened and no longer play a larger role. I mean, this has been shown empirically to be correct. External predators had a hard time getting to Britain for reasons that I mentioned, which is it's hard to invade an island nation with a very powerful navy, and that internal rent-seeking was curbed at least somewhat by the fact that the parliament has a great deal of power and it can constrain the king. Now, it's a high-tax country, and there's a great deal of corruption, so I don't want to overdo this, okay? But eventually, the Enlightenment ideology that objected to corruption becomes increasingly powerful. Now, just a brief digression before I get to the meat of the paper, okay? And that is, why is Britain already richer in, say, 1700? And one is that there's no serious fighting on British soil at all until after 1649, which is the end of the Civil War. It has integrated markets, in part because there's no internal tariffs, but also because it's easier to navigate around the country because it has this shape that no place is further than 50 miles away from the coastline, and there are lots of little harbors. There are profits from the Atlantic and the European trade, including the slave trade, so that's, you know, clearly where the history of capitalism people have a something point. And it has a highly productive agricultural sector. So here are some data about this, and you can sort of see this is the growth rate of real GDP between 1270 and 1700, and again, Great Britain after 1700. And you know, you can sort of see that just in the 50 years before beginning of the 18th century, real GDP per capita is actually growing fairly rapidly. Population, by the way, is declining, reasons that aren't fully understood, but you can sort of see that this is a country that's really already growing. And sort of total factor productivity is growing fairly quickly at the same time when you do, when you, so it's about 0.5% a year, which, you know, is even today would be respectable. Certainly for this time, it's something quite remarkable. And finally, much of this is in agriculture. Okay, so you can sort of see here the rapid growth in labor productivity in agriculture, particularly after 1700. And what that means, and what we know is the case, that the agricultural sector can actually shrink in terms of labor force and send people to the cities where they can do other things not related to agriculture. Now, fair enough, these conditions may be necessary, they're not sufficient, because the Dutch Republic basically is even richer than Britain, but doesn't generate an industrial revolution, which is one of the sort of riddles that still stick around. Now, I can talk about why, but let me just move on. And so what then drives the growth of useful knowledge is what I call Schumpeterian processes, okay? So basically the growth of useful knowledge in Britain. And then the question is, all right, so but this is happening all over Europe. It's happening in France, it's happening in Germany, it's happening in Italy, it's happening in the Low Countries, it's happening everywhere. Why is Britain special? So the argument I'm making is about something I've called upper-tail human capital. Okay, it is an argument not about the entire population, but it is really about the population of the best skilled and the most able artisans. And now you'll see the argument in a minute. So basically, you know, technological progress can happen bottom-up, in which the vast bulk of people engage in some kind of learning by doing, or it can occur top-down, which is there's a small number of inventors, you know, not the, you know, the dozen of sort that Victorian hagiographers write about, but a few hundreds, and I can list most of them for you. But then there are some more people, maybe a few thousands, up to maybe 2% of the adult male labor force, who are basically involved in what we call improvements or tweaks, if you want. So these are sort of micro-inventions, many of them not patented and not registered, but we know that they were taking place. And this is actually recognized at the time. So here are two quotes. I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. But both Adam Smith and David Hume, the two leading intellectuals of Britain during the Industrial Revolution, both Scots, by the way, that's not an accident, essentially, both of them, you know, you can sort of see that he says, very few people, says Adam Smith. And here Hume says again, those who cultivate the sciences are always few in numbers. And this is actually recognized. So my favorite quote is this one. This is by the great scientist Robert Hooke. This is fairly early on. And he talks about, you know, technological change and progress occurring. This newfound world, he said, must be conquered by a Cartesian army. Note, this is Cartesian, not Cartesian. And this is after Cortes, because at the time it was believed erroneously, by the way, that this Cartesian army was well-disciplined and regulated, which it was not, but their numbers be but small. That's true. So the conquest of Mexico by Cortes, you know, in this time of day, was considered to be a great triumph for human kind, which sort of today I think we'd probably dissent from that. But the notion that this is a small number of people who are driving the process, okay, is widely rooted in the belief of people at that time. And so my sense would be, as I said earlier, you know, about 2 or 3% of the labor force. We tried to estimate that in the paper, and I said that sounds about right. So it's a small segment, and it's exactly what you think of as the sort of people located in the upper tails of the distribution. So who were these people? Well, some of them you would call intellectuals. So they would be natural philosophers or scientists, physicians, who had an interest in chemistry. So here are some examples, Stephen Hales and Joseph Priestley, both of them leading intellectuals who all made inventions. Now, some of them were entrepreneurs, so there were some clever businessmen who connected with people with new ideas and made them work. You know, the best example is the potter Josiah Wedgwood, who was in many ways a highly educated man. Some of them were inventors, who people who thought outside the box, or solved the problems through some combination of luck, like James Watt himself, or Edmund Cartwright, many others. And finally, the most indispensable and yet most neglected part are these sort of upper-tail artisans, colliers and millwrights and engineers and architects and surveyors. And an example would be Richard Trevithick, who also built the first high-pressure steam engine. And so the word I like to use in this context is competence. Okay, so this is competence is a key component of innovation. I mean, there are these, but what they refer to at the time as ingenious mechanics. Okay, so there are people who are clockmakers, ironmongers, toy makers, high-end woodmakers, ceramics people, lens grinders, that kind of people. These people who are really good at what they're doing, working with high levels of accuracy and low levels of tolerance. And so what competence really means practically is workmanship and materials. And so competence here may have made all the difference between an inventor like Leonardo da Vinci, who invented lots of things, none of which were ever built in his lifetime, and James Watt. And so I apologize, but now I'm going to expose you to a sample of extremely bad poetry, okay? So the quality of elite workmanship and materials helps explain the time and location of the Industrial Revolution. So here is the bad poem. So the poem is this: the difference between Leonardo and Watt was that Watt had Wilkinson and Leonardo did not. So who, pray, was Wilkinson? Well, this is John Wilkinson. He's an iron master. These are his dates, and he's wearing his Sunday suit here, but that's not, these weren't his work clothes. But he was the kind of artisan you need if you invented a steam engine, because he could actually drill the cylinders at a level of tolerance that actually made these steam engines work. Because, of course, the piston doesn't fit snugly inside the cylinder, you ain't got a steam engine. And so what had this man who built helped him build his steam engines, and that's why what became what. And that kind of relationship replicates itself throughout the Industrial Revolution, and that's what counts. So competence was critical. And somebody has to sort of come to somebody with a blueprint or a model and say, no, build this, scale it up. Build this not once, not twice, but hundreds of times, because I'm a manufacturer. And that, I think, is really hard. And what you need is these people not only to build it, okay, but to tweak it, to make them work better, to fix various problems that weren't thought about. And so this is sort of the second line of attack, if you want, and the paper with Ralph Meisenthal that sort of makes this point. Now, it's important to emphasize that much of this knowledge is tacit knowledge. This is not learned from books. This is not learned in engineering schools, which don't exist. This is taught by masters to apprentices, and I'll come back to that in a little while. But this is basically tacit knowledge. And, John Harris, who was one of the great technological historians of the time, sort of notes that these were absorbed with the sooty atmosphere in which they lived rather than ever consciously learned. And these people would actually have a hard time explaining what it was that they did, except they felt this sort of this was kind of an implicit savoir-faire, I would say, or what the Germans called, Fingerspitzengefühl, that kind of thing. You feel it in your fingers, but you can't quite express it. And so what happens, of course, is that this knowledge therefore spreads fairly slowly and is basically transmitted from masters to apprentices, which turns out to be an important thing. All right, so now, trying to do two things, okay? First, that proof that there's evidence that argues that British mechanics were better than those on the continent. And secondly, that it mattered to industrialization, and if time, come back to it and explain why this was the case. So what's the evidence? Okay, so there's six kinds of evidence that I'm going to present to you, and I hope at least one of them will be somehow persuasive. So first, there's sort of discursive evidence, okay? So There are lots and lots of people who travel around Europe, some of them British, some of them continental, who make this point. So here's a famous quote that many of you may have seen. This is a quote from Jean-Baptiste Say, who wrote in his Traité d'économie politique in 1803, this famous line. This is from the English translation that came out a few years later, and basically says, the wonderful practical skills of her adventurers, which are the entrepreneurs, really, and the the superiority of her workmen. Okay, so this is a Frenchman saying that. Most of the French people, certainly at that time, weren't particularly friendly to Britain, but this is sort of a grudging admission. My favorite quote is actually from a few decades earlier, from a Swiss manufacturer who remarked in 1766 that for a thing to be perfect, he said, it has to be invented in France and worked out in England. That isn't quite right, but the notion that people think so is interesting. Now, about knowledge flows. So there were a lot of continental inventions, and I could list them for you. So France was actually fairly good at inventing things. They invented a whole range of important inventions, but almost all of them first were applied on a large scale in Britain, which is sort of surprising until you realize that, you know, France lacked what Britain had, which is the kind of competent people who could carry out that design. So some of these are well known. Chlorine bleaching, of course, which was invented by Claude Berthollet, one of Lavoisier's most famous students. Soda making, food canning, the Jacquard loom, paper making machinery. Then there's the voltaic pile, which was invented in Italy. Telegraph came out of Denmark. All of these things first are developed on a large scale in Britain. Moreover, there's a great deal of evidence that during the 18th century, there's a massive amount of industrial espionage of continentals, Germans, Austrians, Scandinavians, Frenchmen, Spaniards, who traveled to England and tried to sniff around the factories. And of course, the British know this, so they don't want to let these people in, so they go in under disguise. There's wonderful stories there. There's a massive book by John Harris describing that. Even more striking is that there are many cases in which continentals invent something useful and they have to travel to England to have it built, okay? So one of the most famous cases is this. This is the Argand oil lamp, invented by Aimé Argand, who was not French, but from Geneva. And this thing was built for the first time in England. And then, you know, they cheated him. I mean, he didn't do very well with that. But the fact of the matter is, he felt he had to go to England to get it built. Here's another example. This is Friedrich König, a Saxon inventor, made this machine. This is a high-speed steam-powered printing press. But he had to go and have it built in London from 1806 to 1817 because nobody in Saxony could build it. Then there is what I call sort of policy evidence. Now, you have to keep in mind that these are mercantilists, okay? The 18th century consists most of people who make policy who hadn't read The Wealth of Nations or hadn't understood it. So people still think that if you have a resource like highly skilled artisans, the way to keep your advantage is to prevent them from immigrating. So there are all these laws. First one passed in 1719, in which they try to prevent these people from immigrating. And that actually tells you that these people at least knew that they had something that was better than elsewhere. So, you know, thinking like mercantilists, rather than spreading the knowledge around, they tried to keep them at home. So they both prohibited migration of artisans and the export of machinery, neither of which were very well enforced, obviously. This is the 18th century, but at least people thought so. And so finally, and this is probably the most convincing argument, is the migration of British artisans. So in order to follow the British example, it wasn't enough for continental countries to build the machinery. They had to bring in British technicians, mechanics, and engineers to build them, install them, maintain them, and repair them when they broke down, which happened all the time. And so there are thousands of Scotsmen and Englishmen running around the continent, both in the 18th century and after 1815, setting up factories everywhere because the local people just didn't know how to do it. And so this starts already in the 1720s, you know, and there's all kinds of examples of people like Michael Alcock and John Holker. These are famous cases of Englishmen who flee England for one reason or another, settle in France and help the French set up their manufacturing sector. Now, this sort of slows down between 1791 and 1815 because of war, so there's some going on. But then after the war, this becomes a massive phenomenon. And so people actually investigated. The numbers are kind of iffy, but it's at least one parliamentary committee found that there are 16,000 British artisans that moved to England and France alone. And later on, these are some of the numbers. So a Frenchman called Ben Simon has a wonderful book about this, which describes this in some detail. But it's not just in France. It's true in Belgium, in Germany, in the Habsburg Empire. Even in the Netherlands, you know, the Industrial Revolution is speckled with names like Thomas Ainsworth and William Cockerell. I mean, these are obviously people coming in from Britain. Here's one more example I'm very fond of, okay? This is a man called John Hughes, who was a Welsh ironmaster, and he ended up founding a city called Yuzovska, named after him, right? Yuzovska, named after John Hughes. This is in Donetsk, in the center of the heavy iron industry in the eastern Ukraine. And if you go to Donetsk, I don't recommend it right now, but you never know, that's the statue that you will see. That is John Hughes, an Englishman who basically set up the heavy iron industry in the Donetsk basin. So all the way to Russia, they had to import English people. And so how should we think about this? And one way of arguing this is to say Britain may have an absolute advantage in both inventing and implementing inventions, but there's a comparative advantage in implementing, or as I call it, tweaking. Okay, so it's ingenious mechanics for far better than any other economy in Europe. So here is some data about, these are just inventions, and you can sort of see that obviously Britain plays a large role, but they never have more than half of the major inventions taken at the time. And people have these little different compilations. But you can sort of see that during the Industrial Revolution, they remain under 50%. And by the second quarter of the 19th century, it's already down to about less than 30. And of course, then later on, they become like everybody else. And so it's not that they're not good at inventing, but they're even better at implementing these inventions. That's the argument. And so people at the time say this. James Watt himself had a famous quote in which he says, what's the principal hindrance to erecting engines? It's always the smith's work, you know, it's the people who actually go there and they manipulate the iron. And so can therefore this explain British advantage? Well, so there's a lot of sort of econometric evidence in the paper that I did with two co-authors, was published last year in the JP. But here's one regression, just to give you sort of a flavor of this. As you know, there's 50 more tables like this, as you might imagine. But this is a very simple OLS regression in which we run, this is on the county level, in which we run the log of the number of industrial workers in 1831, which is sort of basically at the end of the Industrial Revolution. And so we did isolate with some trouble the number of what we call mechanics and tool makers, which is a reasonably good proxy. And you can sort of see that it comes out highly significant. And once you throw that in, almost nothing else works except water flow. But water flow is actually correlated with millwrights. We are highly skilled as well. So that actually sort of, and so we do this with two stage least squares, and we do this with correcting for spatial autocorrelation, things like that. It still always works. So now I have one question left, and that is, where are these people coming from? You know, why does Britain have this disadvantage? So, you know, as an economist, you want to separate demand from supply. So let me start with the demand side. And so the first is that on the eve of the Industrial Revolution, say 1700 or thereabout, Britain is already rich. And what's more, it has, believe it or not, a relatively equal income distribution. Now, that's not equal by modern standards, but it's better than France and better than basically any place on the continent, as far as we know. So what it has, and people comment on this, it has a large middling class, as they call it at the time. And so they have middle class consumers who actually buy what was for the time luxury goods. So things like clocks, watches, you know, musical instruments, fancy toys, telescopes, microscopes—the kind of things that people had at home and used on long nights, as well as sort of high-end ceramics and furniture, things like that. Now, these tend to be the kind of industries where high-skill manufacturing and high accuracy manufacturing is required. You know, you can't build a violin unless you know really how to build things very, very accurately. And so these people who were catering to that kind of market actually played an important role in the Industrial Revolution. So an example is, for instance, John Kay of Warrington, who was Arkwright's top mechanic, who was trained as a clockmaker. But there are many other examples that I can give you. Then, of course, there are these focusing devices that I mentioned already earlier. And there's a whole bunch of sectors which actually require a great deal of skill for a variety of reasons. So coal and other mining is really a sector that at many levels required ingenuity, both in finding the coal, extracting it, transporting it, and so on and so forth. Shipbuilding, same thing. So there's a recent paper describing how shipbuilding actually requires a very high level of sophistication if you wanted to ship these ships to last longer than 10 years. Instruments, of course, which required a great deal of skills, clock and watchmaking, millwrights, and many of these sectors were better developed in Britain, in large part because it was already way ahead, and so it produces these high-quality skilled workers. Then, of course, if you would argue that Britain is already richer and was eating better than the rest of the continent, and there's a fair amount of evidence for that, particularly showing that British soldiers during the Napoleonic Wars were about two inches taller than French soldiers, which is kind of an indication in that direction, then you would argue that they would have higher cognitive and physical capability. Now, the difference may not be very large, but it matters for the density in the upper tier of the human capital distribution, because as we know, you know, in a normal distribution, if you increase the mean just by a little bit, you actually increase the density in the upper tail by much more. For instance, you know, you can do a little example. You take a normal distribution with mu 100 and sigma equals 10, then an increase in 1% of the mean would lead to a 50% increase in the density above 4 sigma. Okay, so a little difference in the mean may make a big difference for the upper tail, and that's, of course, what we need. Now, there are other arguments that have been made that are similar. There's a recent paper by Holman, Hannon, and Rosenberger, which actually looks at, calculates some kind of network effect of British patents. I don't want to get into the detail too much, but the argument basically is that in those networks, Britain's concentrated on technologies that were far more centrally located in the network. But clearly, the main argument that I make here is that the difference is in the supply side. And let me spend a few minutes on that. Skilled artisans in this age are manufactured only in one way, and that is through direct contact between master and apprenticeship. There are no schools for engineering before the 19th century, with the, I think, a few exceptions like the École des Mines here in France, but these are very rare. There's none of them in Britain. If you went to Cambridge or Oxford, there's no way you would actually ever take a course in engineering. And the same was even true for the Scottish universities. And so the quality of training by master to the sort of apprentices who worked for them is actually crucial. And so what modern literature shows is that in England, far more than anywhere else, apprenticeship had become a market commodity. So here's a bunch of papers that have made this point. And, you know, the main reason for that is that everywhere on the continent, apprenticeship is still regulated, controlled, and enforced by guilds. And guilds were conservative, in many cases, really crystallized the technology in use. But in Britain, guilds, even though they still exist, they have no power to control apprenticeship, or for that matter, almost anywhere else. They had been weakened by hundreds of years of, you know, Tudor and Stuart government. So in Britain, the apprenticeship system, notwithstanding the weakness of the guilds, and in fact maybe because of that, apprenticeship worked really well. And the sort of one proof of that is that when the statute that regulated it, which is not very well enforced, but it was finally abolished in 1814, and yet apprenticeship survived in Britain until deep into the 19th century, and to some extent into the 20s as well. So this is obviously a very lively, successful institution, more so than on the continent. Now, to understand this, what you have to realize is that the contract between a master and an apprentice is fairly complex, and you could argue, I have argued, that it is in many ways the mother of all incomplete contracts, because you can never specify all contingencies. You can never actually specify the exact nature of the commodity to be transacted, because you could, you didn't have to take those apprenticeships. You just read 1,000 pages of the contract, but needless to say, that's completely unrealistic. So both sides, you know, can engage in opportunistic behavior, and the question is, how do you prevent that? Well, on the continent, much of that was done by guilds. In Europe, in England, that was no longer the case. And so the argument really is that what do we know about what happens when disputes arise between masters and apprentices? And it turns out that many of those contracts were in some many ways self-enforcing through local reputation mechanisms. So Britain is a well-networked society in which within each small provincial town, you know, people are talking to each other, people are communicating with each other. So if somebody reneges on a contract and therefore is branded as such and such is not a gentleman, that was extremely costly. And so in equilibrium, and of course lots of behaviors of the equilibrium path, but in equilibrium, people basically meet the conditions of the contract, which means the master will teach the apprentice properly and the apprentice will stick around as he's supposed to after the completion of the training to help the master do this, okay? So what I call this is that we have in England a civil economy in a civil society. That is to say, an economy in which most people tend to operate in the shadow of the law, but rarely actually use the law to sue. Now, unfortunately, as historians, the records that remain are the people who actually went to court. So we don't know about the rest of the population. But in fact, the numbers are going down over the 18th century. So is there still opportunistic behavior? Of course there is. Is it common enough to disrupt a well-functioning market in human capital? The answer is, in all likelihood, no. And so what the net result is, of course, that Britain produces a flexible and effective training system that produced more competent and agile craftsmen and engineers that is far more effective than anywhere else. Now, here is one piece of evidence that you may find maybe helpful here, and that is that because of the fact that the Industrial Revolution is driven by technology, if the system wasn't able to meet that demand, you would see an increase in the skill premium of the labor. Well, here's the skill premium from 1700 to 1910, and it's actually going down. Now, it hops up a little bit during the early days of the Industrial Revolution, but then the system adjusts, and you can see that by 1800, it's down again. And it goes up a little bit and goes down, but the long trend is good. So what this tells you is that this is a system that when new demands for skills, not necessarily better skills, just different skills, comes up, it can adjust. It's agile, it's adaptable, it can produce what the market needs. And that is almost completely lacking on the continent until, I'd say, the first half of the 19th century. And then as the guilds get, abolished by the French Revolution and so on, then, what we see is that eventually the continent can catch up. So here's in sum, well, we'll see. I'll play a Paul David on you. Sorry, I couldn't resist that. I'm kidding. Britain had a major advantage, not because it had better science, which it did not, or nor because it had more inventors, which it might have, but not by that proportion, but above all because it had better craftsmen and mechanic, and it had better craftsmen because it was better at supplying them. So, epilogue. So why did Britain lose its dominant position? And the answer is, I think, this. The nature of technological progress changes over the course of the 18th century. In the second half of the 18th century, it is still true that most technological advances are made by these sort of dexterous polymaths, if you want, clever engineers or gifted tinkerers, as they're sometimes known, with only an occasional dependence on science. But after 1800, the dependence on formal science starts to increase. You know, the low-hanging fruits of tinkering had been picked, and further progress depends on breakthroughs in scientific understanding. But what's more is there is a decline of tacitness, which is means essentially the end of British technological leadership, because you know the system can train engineers in formal schools using formal textbooks. And so over time, technical competence becomes less tacit and more codified. As many books about engineering are being produced and read and used in schools. And interestingly enough, most of these books were written by Frenchmen. So here's one example. This is written by a man called Augustin de Betancourt, who despite his name, actually was Spanish in origin, but he worked in France, and this is published in France. And this is actually opened it. This is a detailed book. I mean, you can learn engineering from this book. I mean, I got lost in page 7. So, but it's sophisticated. And there's scores of books like this about mining, about textiles, about chemistry, published in France, in Spain, in Germany, and then eventually translated into English and used by the English. That tells you something. So this basically makes this point, okay? And at that point, it becomes clear that Britain has no advantage in scientific or intellectual upper tail human capital. In fact, since after Newton, it's sort of hard to think of any sort of really major scientists that British produced. There is no British equivalent to Lavoisier, Laplace, Ampère, Coulomb, Sadi Carnot, and a whole bunch, not to mention mathematicians like, you know, Euler, Bernoulli, Lagrange, and on and on and on. I mean, there are some in England that are good. None of them are of that kind of quality. Now, of course, the Scottish Enlightenment was next door, and the Scottish Enlightenment was better than the English Enlightenment, but even there, it isn't anything compared to, say, Lavoisier's Élément, which really was a path-breaking achievement. And what this means, I think that eventually British advantage was inexorably, I would say, ephemeral. It wasn't going to stick around because these other countries are catching up, because knowledge becomes more and more codified, and these highly skilled artisans aren't good enough. You need people who have actually gone to university and know the math and know the chemistry and know the physics. And in that regard, Britain not only isn't very good, they're actually falling behind as they themselves are whining increasingly over the 19th century. So eventually, you know, by 1900, it's clear that Britain is not even a primus inter pares. It's just part of Paris, so to speak. And so that really is, I think, critical to understand the unique role that Britain plays in the Industrial Revolution, which they were critically important in the early stages, but not later on. And that creates an equilibrium that we observe in the 20th century. So Britain lost its technological leadership in the last third. And there's this big literature of whether Victorian Britain failed or not. And I'm not going to get into that. But there is a sense, certainly in Britain itself, that, hey, we were once so great, and now these Germans and these Frenchmen and these Americans are threatening to overtake us, okay? Now, what is lost to some extent is that this is certainly true today in the sort of post-Brexit disastrous performance of the British economy, is its precocity in the fact that, you know, they were there first. And that's what made them into the holy land of industrialization. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.